You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Morning. I want to welcome everybody here today to the second annual Donald C. Lubick Symposium. Also want to welcome all the people who are watching on webcast. My name is Mark Mazur. I'm the Robert C. Posen Director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. I've been at the Tax Policy Center now for just over 2 months, and it really is a great pleasure to be here with you all today. The Lubick Symposium was created to honor the extraordinary record of Don Lubick. He's a very special kind of public servant. In his service at the Department of Treasury, he was Tax Legislative Counsel, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, and Assistant Secretary twice. And throughout it all, Don Lubick was dedicated to promoting the cause of a better tax system. He could boil this down to his adherence to three principles: efficiency, equity, and simplicity. And Don Lubick was a model to some. He was a mentor to some and a great colleague to others. And it's really a tribute. It's a real tribute to him that the tax community honors him with this symposium. Don wanted to be here today, but he had an accident that injured his foot, and so he's unable to show up here. He's out of commission for a few weeks, but Joe Guntag wanted to say a few words on behalf of Don.
Thank you, Mark. I'm Joe Guntag. Don sent me a note and asked me to read it to you. Dear friends, I'm sorry not to be with you physically, though I'm connected through a link. Unfortunately, I broke my ankle on Tuesday and forced to recuperate at home. I will really miss being present in person because the topic is one of great interest and importance, and one we in tax policy world treat more marginally than warranted. I am grateful for associating my name with this second annual event. I hope it is not to honor my contributions. They only result from the many lawyers and economists more capable than I who made my stays at the Office of Tax Policy the most capable operation I could ever have dreamed of being a part. One thing, however, leads me to be happy with associating my name to this program. That is my desire to proclaim to tax experts and the taxpaying public the contribution of the Tax Policy Center to the enlightenment it furnishes to the tax world, the governments, federal and state, and the public. It does this by furnishing impartial and thoroughly accurate data and analysis necessary in the making of tax policy that, to the extent possible, can combine the past to simplicity, equity, and economic growth.
So we got a little address from Don Lubick here. Thanks for that. I know you're watching on the webcast. And thanks for all you've done for tax policy in general. There's a couple housekeeping items that I want to mention today. One is we really encourage audience participation. So during the Q&A portion today, there'll be folks going around with microphones. You should all feel free to grab one and ask a question or make a comment. Similarly, for folks who are on the webcast, watching on the webcast, you can connect with us via Twitter using the hashtag TaxFacts. I think that about covers the housekeeping portions for today. So let me introduce our keynote speaker, Vanessa Williamson. She's a fellow in governance studies at Brookings Institution. Vanessa's been studying perceptions of the tax system for several years, recently released a book titled Read My Lips: Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes, and also just conducted a survey quiz in conjunction with Vox.com that generated some interesting data that she'll share with us today. Personally, I find this topic fascinating. Paying taxes is an annual ritual that pretty much every household in America goes through. Way more people pay taxes than vote, and so it's one of the few things that, as a country, we share and it kind of knits us together. And so having Vanessa here to talk about that, really, I was just delighted by that, and looking forward to having her help shed some light on these important issues and relationships. So please join me in welcoming Vanessa Williamson here today.
Thank you all for having me today. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you a little bit, both about my new research and some work I've been doing before that, on the question of tax fairness, right? So the question I want to talk to you about is this one. What makes taxes seem fair, right, to members of the general public, as opposed to, say, let's say, tax policy professionals and experts like the folks in this room? But as a general rule, you know, there are several reasons to think this question is important. You might want, for instance, people to feel good about the taxpaying process for reasons of fiscal sustainability, right? It would be great if taxpaying were not such a controversial issue that the federal government and states and cities see large fluctuations in their budget as taxes become very controversial and you have sudden shifts in tax rates or base. You might also think it's an important question, just because, you know, at the end of the day, wouldn't you like it to be the case that people living in a democracy are relatively happy about the public policies that affect them, as taxes certainly do? And then finally, to the extent that you think of taxes as attitudes about taxes as a kind of referendum on government, right, because this is the money people are chipping in to make that government run, so people's attitudes about that, whether that expense is worth paying or whether that money's being used well or whether it's being collected fairly, these are questions you might think are just important from a perspective of democratic accountability, right? So this is a question I think a lot about, and I think about it in two parts. The first one is, what values do Americans want to see guiding tax policy, right? What do they think are the principles that would make tax policy seem fair? For instance, do they think that taxes should be progressive? Do they think rich people should pay a larger percentage, not just a larger amount, right? Or do you think, another way of thinking about that, you might say, do you think we should be putting taxes on things that we don't like cigarettes or alcohol, something like that, so that what taxes really are a way to limit behavior that we disapprove of, right? So are those values that people want to see implemented, or which values do people want to see implemented in their tax policy? The other question, of course, is what facts about tax policy do people actually have to work with when they're making evaluations of public policy, right? And I think this is, of course, on an issue like taxation, which is so complicated, a really difficult barrier between people's values and their policy preferences, right? It's sometimes hard for people to see which policies would actually implement the values, even if they're clear about what principles they think should guide tax policy. So one way to think about a value that might guide tax policy is a very common one when we talk professionally about tax policy, is a benefit principle, right? And this is the idea that one's tax costs should be more or less equal and ideally less than the benefits one receives from government, right? Now, there's some theoretical issues with a sort of actually evaluating whether you're getting value for your money in sort of a consumer perspective, right? And two of them I'll just talk briefly about. First of all, obviously, when taxes pay for public goods, things like roads and clean air and clean water, and, you know, I think it's reasonable to think that that's hard to value, and it's particularly, I'd imagine, hard for average people busy with their lives to think about how to value those kinds of things. And secondly, of course, and this is the sort of, you know, conundrum in taxation, the tax system, one of the things it provides is the money that operates our legal system, which protects property rights. So you get a little recursion problem, right? When you're thinking about the value of taxes, one of the things it does is protect the total property that you have. So without the taxes, how much of that property would you maintain, you know, if you really imagined no taxes at all? So there's a little recursion problem, a little turtles all the way down problem when you're thinking about a benefit principle of taxation. But this is a very common way to think about taxes, right? Like the same way I buy something at the store, am I getting value for my money? Am I getting value for my taxes? Okay. So there's been some research on this question, and the evidence, I think, is mixed in terms of to what extent we can identify people using a benefit principle to evaluate their taxes. Sometimes it seems to be pretty clearly there in the data, and sometimes it's not. So there are two examples that I think have gotten a little bit of attention. One is the idea of a federal tax receipt. The White House ran something kind of like this on their website for a long time. You could see, you put in the amount that you pay in taxes, and it spits out the federal budget that shows you, you know, approximately where each of those dollars would went if it was split evenly across the federal budget. There have been some experiments done to see what effect that has on people's attitudes, either their knowledge, first of all, about what government does, or their attitudes about whether they think their taxes are used well. And there have been really very limited results, even on the knowledge portion of that. So that hasn't been a huge success, but maybe, you know, it just needs to be done better. That's always possible. You need to present information more clearly. That could be one of the limitations. Where you've seen, I think, some real success is in Social Security receipts. some of you may remember at one point receiving a green piece of paper that told you about the, you know, the contributions you'd made to the Social Security Fund and what benefits you were likely to receive when you retired. And so one of the neat things about that, and some of you may already know this, that was rolled out as a randomized experiment so you could really measure what it did for people's knowledge of Social Security. And they found that those sort of receipts both increased people's knowledge about the Social Security program, how it works, and their own benefits, but also their confidence in the system. So that was a real win, right? So when it comes to thinking about a benefit principle, there's some evidence that you can have an impact that way. But there's another way of thinking about taxes, which is actually more of what my work is on. And I think sometimes, you know, of course, because it's my work, I think, you know, more people should think of things this way. And that value is ethical reciprocity, right? And this is an idea that Margaret Levy talks a lot about, but it's the idea that you're willing to do your part, your sort of civic duty, when you think other people are also chipping in a fair share, right? So this treats taxpaying less like a consumer interaction, where you're like looking at the cost of the car and deciding whether it's worth it to you to buy, and more like something like military service, right? So that you're thinking, well, you know, there's this big task that we as a country need to do. I'll do my part, but if I see everyone else skipping out, maybe I'll free ride too, right? So it's sort of the collective action free rider problem more than the sort of basic straightforward consumer interaction, individualized consumer interaction. Now, there's some evidence in the tax compliance literature that this matters, right? If you look cross-nationally, there's a relationship, certainly, between people's sense of tax morale and the level of compliance in the country, although, of course, the withholding system and the enforcement of the IRS are also, of course, critically important to tax compliance. But there is some evidence that tax morale matters, too, that your sense that this is a civic norm, that this is a social norm we all share, that we're going to do our part and pay taxes, to the extent that that is agreed upon by the sort of population of the country, it does help predict a little bit what actual tax compliance we see. And in the United States, tax morale is very high, right? Americans are exceptionally committed to the idea that taxpaying is a civic duty. And this is just, this on the bottom you can see it's about 40 years of survey data going back to the early 80s, and the y-axis is just the percentage of respondents who agree or disagree with the statement. And this is, it gets asked in a lot of different surveys in a lot of different ways, but these are all questions about the civic duty of taxpaying. So for instance, the little line of D's at the top are the idea, whether you agree with that it's every American civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes, right? And then some of the others are phrased in the opposite form, so they're saying, you know, the government wastes a lot of money, so it's not really that bad to hold back a little on your taxes, right? This is the percentage of people who disagree with that statement. And what you find is, I mean, first of all, real consistency over 40 years across question wordings, across survey firms, and also very, very high agreement, right? So 80 and 90% of people agreeing with the idea that taxpaying is an important civic duty. No, it's not okay to hold back, even if I give you kind of an excuse in the question. So this idea, if we think of taxpaying as a civic duty, more like military service, it's a little bit of evidence that maybe ethical reciprocity, this idea, I'll chip in if you chip in, is underlying people's tax attitudes, or it might be worth trying to look at. Another piece of data that suggests that ethical reciprocity might be a way to think about tax fairness is this question. This question gets asked very regularly. This happens to be a Pew question from 2015. And they asked, what bothers you the most about taxes? Now, in the full sample, about 14% said nothing bothered them a lot about taxes, so they got dropped. This is among the 86% of people who were bothered a lot by at least something. And you'll see, probably a little hard to read because the screen's divided, but the two big columns on the left say the feeling that corporations don't pay their share, and then the feeling that the wealthy don't pay their fair share, right? And then the amount you actually pay in taxes is the fourth column. Only about 8% of respondents thought that the amount that they actually personally paid in taxes was the thing that really bothered them about taxes, right? And then you'll see the last column that I want to sort of draw your attention to is the 5%, which is just to the right of the amount you pay, is the feeling that poor people aren't paying your fair share. So if you ask people what bothers them most about taxes, the thing that really motivates a lot of people is about two-thirds of respondents in total is the idea that someone else isn't chipping in, right? So it suggests to me that we should think a little more about this possibility that ethical reciprocity is everyone else doing their part is an important part of people's considerations, not just the benefits they get from government. Okay. So that was the values section. Now let's talk about the facts. Of course, this is hard, right? Tax policy is hard, or else we would not all have jobs working on that kind of question, right? And it's very common for people to have misconceptions about the tax code. And in particular, in my research, I think people have a huge limitation in their understanding of how different taxes affect Americans across the income distribution, right? So I'll talk about two reasons you see that. One thing is that people tend to confuse hassle with cost. So the federal income tax is a lot of hassle, but it is not a lot of cost to most Americans, certainly the bottom half of the income distribution. But that bottom half of the income distribution feels just as hassled by the income tax process as everyone else, right? So there tends to be a confusion there. So people focus on the income tax, the federal income tax, a little more than would really make sense if they were just thinking about which taxes cost them the most, because the payroll tax and the sales tax are very expensive for a lot of people in the lower half of the income spectrum. And then, of course, the federal income tax is very politically prominent as well, right? So you've got both the daily experiential thing drawing your attention to the federal income tax, the sort of tax season, right? And then alongside that, of course, the federal income tax is the thing that people on TV and politicians talk about a lot more than, at least at a national level, than all the other taxes that people pay. So I'll just give you one specific example of how the experience of tax paying can mislead people about how the income distribution is affected by a particular tax. So on the sales tax, there's a substantial percentage of people who misunderstand the sales tax as a progressive tax, when in fact it typically, not that it can't be a progressive tax, but typically in the United States it is not. It falls more heavily on low-income people than high-income people. But if you ask people about how the sales tax affects people at different income levels, if you're not, lower-income people know that it's very expensive to them personally, unsurprisingly. They're watching their pennies at the register. But once you're in the middle class or above, you don't really think about the sales tax. It doesn't feel very prominent. An extra dollar here, two here or there doesn't really matter. Except when you buy something expensive, if you bought a really fancy pair of shoes, if you bought a computer, if you bought a car, then suddenly 7% sales tax, wow, is that a big number, right? So because people have this experience, it's common for people when they're trying to figure out, and this I found through open-ended surveys and also through interviews, when they're trying to think through, okay, I've never really thought about who pays a lot in sales tax. Well, it was expensive to me when I bought something expensive, so it must be expensive to the wealthy, right? And now, that's not a failure of basic math, right, which is reassuring. It's not an enumeracy problem. It's a failure to recognize that consumption and income don't scale together, right, that as you become more high earning, you consume less of your income and you save more, basically, right? But that people don't recognize that basic reality, and so they misunderstand the impact of the sales tax. All right. So there are these mistakes people have that make it hard for them to identify what policies they should support given their values. So if you think that the sales tax falls heavily on the wealthy and you think the wealthy should pay more, which is a common thing to believe, then you're likely to think a national sales tax might be the way to go to make sure that the wealthy people pay their share, when in fact it would be quite likely that such a policy would do the opposite of what you wanted to see. Okay, so I'm interested in this question of, if you give people facts, does it change their attitudes about fairness? Okay, and so the Tax Policy Center has worked with Vox in the past, and we were chatting about, do you want to do like a tax policy quiz for Tax Day? Wouldn't that be fun? And I thought to myself, why don't we put an experiment in there, right? Because then you don't just find out the overall answers of what do people who go to the Vox website know about taxes, but you also get a little bit of information about how people like Vox viewers, our readers, would feel differently if they had different information, right? So we worked with Vox to do an online quiz that contained in it an experiment, and I'll explain how that worked in a second. It would have looked like this if you went to the website. You got to place what looks a little bit like Tax Jeopardy, right? And here's how the experiment actually worked. Every participant answered 4 fact questions and 4 opinion questions, right? But not everyone got the same questions, right? And so we specifically set up the questions to draw your attention to different parts of the tax code, and I'll show you that in a minute. So people were randomly assigned, which is the crucial part of this, right? So they're similar on average, except for the fact that they got a different set of questions at random, to 1 of 5 groups. Either the control group, right, which is the people who answered the opinion questions first, meaning that they answered the opinion questions with whatever facts they had in their head already about taxes, or 1 of 4 treatment groups, right? And so these are the people who answered some fact questions before they got to the opinion section. And here were those 4 groups. One set of respondents got a set of questions intended to emphasize that high-income people pay a lot in taxes. One group got a set of questions designed to make them think that high-income people pay little in taxes. One group of people got a set of questions that focused on taxes affecting low-income people and implied that low-income people pay a lot. And a last set of questions asked people about things that tend to be tax breaks for low-income people, so implying that poor people pay a little bit. Now, all of these facts are accurate, of course. I'm just drawing your attention to different parts of the tax code. So that looked like this. If I want to make you think that high-income people pay a lot in taxes, we can talk about marginal rates, right? If I want to make you think that low-income people pay a little in taxes, I can draw your attention to loopholes, right? If I want to make you think that low-income people pay a lot in taxes, we'll talk about grocery taxes. And at last, if I want to make you think that low-income people don't pay much in taxes, let's talk about the earned income tax credit, right, which is a refundable tax credit for low- to moderate-income families, right? So if I draw your attention to these different parts of the tax code, I might be able to change your ideas. Here's what we found. First of all, tax facts matter, and I thought that was great news, right? We could shift people's opinions by showing them different questions. But interestingly, at least for the Vox audience, questions about low-income people mattered more. The questions about high-income people didn't make much of a difference, and I'll show you that in a second. Secondly, tax fairness works like a seesaw, right? And I'll talk to you about what that means. And then finally, which is the little bit of the bleakest piece of news, ignorance might be bliss, right? We were talking at the beginning about the idea that what we want people to be is both informed about the taxpaying process and also happy. Those may not come together in one clean package. Okay, tax facts matter. So we asked several opinion questions, but I'm going to talk to you right now about people's assessment of their own tax fairness, right? So we gave them information about different parts of the tax code, and then we asked them whether they saw their own taxes as fair. And what you see here is the mean is 54%. 54% of people in any of the, combined together, 54% of the respondents thought that their taxes were fair. But if we showed you questions about low or income people paying relatively high tax rates, so I talked to you about grocery taxes, that reduced people's sense of their own tax fairness. By contrast, if I talk to you about ways that low-income people get tax breaks, things like the earned income tax credit, that actually increased people's sense of their own tax fairness about 4% higher. And I should say that for a survey experiment, these are quite large effects. I spent the entire week very nervous we weren't going to see anything while we were running the experiment, but these are really quite noticeable effects. By contrast, higher-income people, whether I talk to you about them paying low taxes or high taxes, had relatively small impact. And I can talk to you a little bit about why, but let me go through the results. And we can talk about why I think maybe information about low-income taxpaying versus high-income taxpaying mattered. All right, fairness is a seesaw. Interestingly, if I focused your attention with these questions on taxes that make questions that make taxes on the poor seem high, people responded by thinking that taxes on the rich must be too low. Right? So you think one end's high, the other end must be low. I'll show you that in specific. Overall, 42% of Vox respondents in the control group, the ones who had not seen any extra facts, thought that high-income people pay too little in taxes. This is a bit higher than the American public as a whole, somewhere in the 60s it normally is, but Vox readers are unsurprisingly leaning a little on the left. So 82% of Vox respondents thought high-income people are not paying enough. That went up to 86% if I talked to you about loopholes and things like that, right? So I got an effect there, as you would expect. I talked to you about ways that low-income people or high-income people don't pay that much in taxes. You responded by thinking that high-income people should pay more. But I actually got not that much of a larger effect, but technically a larger effect if I talked to you not about what high-income people pay at all. I only talked to you with these questions about the taxes paid by low-income people. So people who got no extra information than they already came in with about high earners and their taxes. If I talked to you about things like the grocery tax, it made you think that even more than me talking directly about high earners, it made you think that rich people should pay more. All right, last point before I close out here. Ignorance might be bliss. All right, before we were talking about the difference in people's sense of fairness among these four groups, I've now added an extra bar, which is the control group, right? And what you can see is the bar on the left, which is the control group, had the highest assessments of fairness of any of the quizzes, right? So if I gave you no information about tax policy whatsoever, you thought taxes were more fair than if I gave you any information at all. Not great news, but there's some ways to think about this that I think are important. First of all, I gave you a very hard tax quiz, right? Maybe people felt down because it was hard, even if they did well. Although I looked at people who did well, and they were not as happy as the control group either. But maybe just having to answer some hard questions, it put you in a little bit of a more negative mood, right? That's one thing. Or maybe it may be that the questions didn't make you think about taxes only. It made you think about income inequality. And so maybe you think everything's less fair if I've reminded you that very wealthy people are doing this or that very poor people are doing that, right? So it may be that these other considerations are the thing that really make the difference, right? But we should take into account the possibility that informing people and making people happy are not the same activity, right? All right. I want to talk quickly about the limitations, and we should talk more about this, but I should wrap up. Vox readers, you will be shocked to discover, are not a random sample of Americans, right? They are on average wealthier, more liberal, and the quiz takers, even though this is not true of the Vox readership as a whole, were substantially more male than female. And of course, the strangest thing about them is that they were willing to take a tax policy quiz. Yeah? So, you know, this is an unusual group, right? And I actually, my instinct with it was that we were going to find pretty small effects, because these have to be people who are either very well informed about taxes or misinformed but sure that they know about taxes, right? But we got quite large effects. So the two main questions I have is, one, whether conservatives would respond differently, right? And I talked to you about how the low-income taxpayers, people liked finding out that low-income people don't pay much in taxes and were upset to find out that low-income people pay a lot in taxes, right? It lowered their sense of fairness, that second option. It might be that conservatives have a reverse view. It might be that conservatives are primarily in that group that think poor people should pay more in taxes that I showed you at the beginning. And so you might actually see a switch there. But I think the interesting thing is the possibility that most people don't think about taxes paid by low-income people at all, right? And so that's why you saw those things matter. People have pretty strong opinions about whether rich people need to pay more. That's a politically contested issue. People have a strong partisan view on it. People might not think as much about taxes that affect low-income people, right? So I think conservatives might respond differently, but I would still expect most of the difference to come at the low-income side of the spectrum. Finally, would less engaged people respond differently? As I told you, I was worried we weren't going to see enough of an effect because these were people with strong opinions. I still think that in a group with less strongly held opinions, you might even see a larger effect. But that's a hypothesis. So my next step is definitely to run a sort of similar survey experiment. Not as much of a quiz and not as cute of graphics because I'm not Vox, but a similar kind of experiment in a nationally representative sample. And actually, I've begun doing that now. That's being fielded starting this week. So I will be able to report back to you more information about this kind of question in a few months. Thank you very much.
Ready to go?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for the presentation. That was, I think, very informative. And the results you get out of the survey bring a bunch of questions to mind. So I just want to go through a couple of them, and then we'll turn it over to the crowd for additional ones. As you mentioned, just about everybody who's economically active in the population files a tax return. And that means they interact with their government at least once a year when they complete this tax return. Mm-hmm. What are, like, the top words or phrases that describe how people feel about that interaction?
So I think that people have several conflicting ideas in their head when they're thinking about taxes. One is that people see being a taxpayer as an important part of their civic obligations. It's part of being a good citizen. And you will recognize this in sort of popular speech. How often have you heard someone say, well, I pay my taxes. I'm a taxpayer. And, you know, and this is strange because it describes basically literally anyone engaging in a market economy. It's sort of a funny place to put your chips, right? But people in America in particular see tax paying as something that is evidence of being a good citizen, right? Someone who contributes to their community. So that's one consideration people have when they're paying their taxes. Of course, the other, and so it's a little bit about who's in their community and who's out, right? Because what they want is to be able to pay taxes to support their community. But some of us don't see that everyone in America should be part of our community, right? So there's that tension. The other tension, of course, is attitudes about the government, right? And whether you think the government is behaving correctly with your taxes. So unfortunately, the federal income tax, while on the one hand it is this direct interaction with government, which I think is really important for people to have as citizens, right? The opportunity to recognize the government plays an important role in their lives and that they should be able to judge the quality of that government and respond to it because this is a democracy. But the information they get from the taxpaying process is not always very positive, right? Because this is an arcane process. This is confusing. Also, people often have very negative ideas about the IRS and sort of this, which the IRS sort of becomes a symbol of government overreach and government's intrusion into your life, right? So on the one hand, they have this very positive view, which is why I call my book Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes, because they see taxpaying as this important civic responsibility. On the other hand, the federal income taxpaying process draws people's attention to the confusion of government, the lack of clarity, and particularly the idea that wealthier people or people with special fancy lawyers can look at this tax form and make magic occur and not pay any taxes while I look at it and get confused and worried, right? So it gives them a sense that maybe government doesn't work equally for everyone.
And so one point that you made in the presentation was this idea that on the one hand, we sometimes think about people who are participating in a tax system as almost being like part of a purchasing co-op, right?
Right.
We we put money in and we get some goods and services out. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned the experiment the Obama administration did with the tax receipt. Mm-hmm. And you said that the evidence was a little mixed as yep. to what the value of that was. Do people really not know what they're purchasing? And given that information, does that help them?
So, yes, there are. I focused primarily on the tax side, but on the spending side, there is, of course, massive misinformation in terms of where tax money goes, right? As a general rule, people feel very good about money that's spent locally, that they can see in their communities that has a physical presence. So roads, schools, hospitals, you know, bridges, all infrastructure, and then to the extent they remember it, things like the sewer system and clean water, if they recall those things, they really like them, but they don't always remember all those things, right? So that's what's really popular. Then at the very bottom, the least popular things are two things. Anything that might, you know, bailouts, corporate aid, corporate tax breaks, no one ever mentions those except to say they don't like them. And then foreign aid is the other thing that basically no one mentions unless they don't like it. And I should be clear that when many people talk about foreign aid, they do not mean what policymakers mean by foreign aid, which is a very limited part of the budget. They see a sort of blurrier line between official foreign aid and foreign military interventions that are described in humanitarian terms. So people do hugely overestimate the foreign aid budget, but that overestimation is not as large as you think, because people are also, they're not really clear on where the line is between the foreign aid that goes to a place like Afghanistan and the military investment that goes to a place like Afghanistan. And that, to some extent, is reasonable, right? That's not, it's a clear line in the budget, but it's not a clear line probably on the ground, and it's certainly not a clear line from, you know, the sort of average viewer's perspective. So people have misconceptions about, and then there's the sort of third category, which is what you might think of as most of the welfare state, right? So this is healthcare, this is aid to the poor. Also, military spending, to some extent, is a kind of mixed bag for people. And so on those things, you really find, first of all, partisan divides, and you also find a far more focus on aid to the poor than is really in line with the budgetary cost of those things. Because like separating out Social Security and Medicare, which are seen differently by the public, but sort of what most people in the public might describe as welfare, but we would describe as a bunch of separate programs that are means-tested, those things come in for more attention than anything else, including roads and schools, and people have very mixed feelings about.
And change gears a little bit. In the olden days, people would sit at their kitchen table with a pencil and paper and do their tax return by hand. Now, half the people go to a paid preparer, another third use software. Mm-hmm. Does that change the basic experience of paying taxes?
My instinct is that it definitely does. I wish that I could have been there recording the data along the way to actually demonstrate this.
You're not nowhere near old enough.
I'm afraid so. But the... You know, one of the things that I think, so marginal rates are very poorly understood. The idea that your income is taxed only above the bracket of the income below a bracket is taxed at that bracket level, the income above a bracket level is taxed at a new rate, but it doesn't apply to your whole income. That is very poorly understood. But back when you had to look it up in a table, it's possible that would have been clearer. Now, it's not completely certain, but I think that that's one thing that may have gotten lost a little bit when you just type some numbers into software and it spits out an answer and you need to send in $100 or you get $100 back or whatever it is. You lose a little bit of that connection to what rates mean and what, you know, and the extent to which rates matter as well, I think. Yeah.
So one thing the Tax Policy Center spent a fair amount of time on over the years is the alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the pencil and paper days, it would be almost impossible for someone to comply with the alternative minimum tax. That way. Now, on software, using software, you put a bunch of information in, and an answer spits out without you ever having to navigate your way through that.
Right.
Does that affect the way people feel about the complexity of a provision?
Yeah, and definitely. I think that having it be sort of a black box is not great for democratic accountability, and I think it's not great for people's sense of how these things work. Particularly because it's all mediated, through, your accountant or some software. It's not even, the government part of it becomes less and less visible, I think, over time. I think that is a real challenge for people to identify, particularly when we try and do social policy through the tax code, for people to identify what things benefit them. And I think that's a real problem, and a bunch of other scholars have made this point, too, that, when Social Security is clear to people because you get a check, right? You start doing things, distantly through, like manipulating the economy, which might be the efficient way to have particular benefits occur. If people can't identify those benefits and support them, then the democratic process isn't really operating the way you'd like it to, right? So, yeah, I think that's very problematic.
And so based on your work, when people file their taxes, do they try to do the right thing? Like you have 80 or 90% of people saying that, you know, it's important to pay your fair share. Mm-hmm. So do they try to do the right thing, or do they maybe misreport a little bit so that they reduce their taxes, but they don't misreport enough that they, like, call an audit upon themselves? So do they, what do they try to do?
Well, I think, I mean, most people have almost no impact on how their taxes get done because they work for wages or salary and it's withheld, and they, you know, there's not great room to maneuver if what you wanted to do was avoid paying your taxes. Frankly, it's quite difficult for salaried employees, I think, to do that. And you remember, most people don't even itemize, right? So there's not much room for most people to have much impact on their own tax compliance at the end of the day. I think that I found a variety of attitudes, right? And I can't apply, I'm not being the IRS, I cannot actually interpret whether people are telling me accurately about their taxpaying experiences, right? There were a small number of people who saw the taxpaying process as a puzzle that they liked to solve, right? This is not personally my attitude. I found it very hard to understand. But that, you know, that this was like, I'm going to try and think through all the ways that I can put in all my and not to do anything illegal by any stretch of the imagination, but they like to think the process through and find all the ways to sort of win at what they felt was like a game, right? Far more common than that attitude, I have found, is just wanting to get it done and get it done right and have it be over, right? That was by far the most common reaction. And particularly, you know, because when people file their own taxes, they have to remember what they think of in a sort of general category as their loopholes. And that's true at every income level because of things like the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit. You have to remember these very specific provisions that will make a big difference for you, right? Remembering your EITC makes a big difference for you. Remembering your home mortgage makes a big difference for your taxes, right? You don't have to remember or even think at all about rates. So unfortunately, one of the impacts of that is that it leaves people thinking that loopholes are the only thing that matter for the tax code, and they discount the effect of the graduated income tax. But the graduated income tax is, of course, very important. It achieves quite a lot of progressivity, particularly compared to other countries, right? So I think that people filing their income taxes, I think the most common opinion is just to want to get it done right and have it be done. But the experience reminds them that tax paying is a game that can be played, and there's someone out there playing it better, and that's unfair.
So in terms of the tax administration agency, you talked a little bit about tax morale and how an improvement in tax morale could lead to improvement in compliance. What are the two or three things that the tax administrator, like the IRS, could do to improve tax morale in the United States?
Well, I certainly think that to the extent that you can make it easier for people to file their income taxes, you are making Americans a lot happier, right? Because as I said, people confuse hassle and cost. Mm-hmm. And the income tax is a hassle. And for many people, it needn't be, really, because their taxes are very, very simple from an administrator's perspective, but very, very complicated from an individual perspective, right? So that's one thing. Another thing that I think, and this is something I've been sort of trying to maybe test out, is giving people the opportunity when they file their taxes to also remind them, oh, do you need to update your voter registration? Have you registered to vote? Right? Because as you mentioned right at the beginning, there's this huge gap between the percentage of people who file their taxes and the percentage of people who vote. Now, obviously, there are people who file taxes who shouldn't vote, right? But they also go to the DMV and get, you know, their driver's license and are reminded, oh, but do you want to register to vote, right? So I think, like motor voter, we could have something like filer voter, right? Because you're already interacting with government. You're already filling out a form. You're already thinking about how government matters to you, right? You're either getting a refund that year or you're paying in. You're reminded that government's very important for your daily life. And whether you're angry or happy about that, it's a great time in my estimation. It would be a great time to remind people that they have a say. Not a big say, but a very small say, but a say in the policies that are affecting their lives, right? So to me, what I would love to see, and I'm going to attempt to do this experimentally in the next year, is test out whether reminding people to register to vote in the spring helps them actually get out there and make decisions about the country that they live in the fall.
And so one last question on this. When you talked a little bit about the connection of filing a tax return to voting in this case. We've seen a lot of people in the financial literacy side of the world want to connect the time of tax filing with other things like signing up for a retirement account, saving, doing something like that. How effective are those those activities?
I mean, I think there's been mixed success. Some have shown real success, and some are less so. And one of the challenges is particularly, you know, there's been a lot of economic uncertainty in the last few years, so people are in a different position in terms of their capacity to save. When economic uncertainty is high, certain things become harder for people. But I think in general, it's clearly, you know, a lot of people want to use this moment because it's an unusual moment. You're thinking about your finances, you're thinking about your government, and while of course the process should be easier and better, I would not want to eliminate there being a couple of days out of the year where Americans think about these questions, right? I would like it to be a time where they have better information to work with, better information to use to make these important financial and political decisions, right? But I wouldn't want it to just disappear at all, right? I think this is a moment that we should be harnessing to improve not only people's financial health, but also their capacity to act as citizens.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation, but I think I should maybe let other people enter it as well. So I'd like to open things up for questions from the audience. You have a question, just raise your hand and we'll try to get a microphone over to you. So we have a question up here in the front.
Hi, I'm Len Berman. You talked a little bit about compliance and the fact that wage and salary workers obviously can't underreport their income and get away with it, and we see the compliance very high for them. Compliance is very low for self-employed people, and the IRS has, Congress has been cutting the IRS's budget for decades now, and the audit rates are really, really low. If people see taxes and as a civic responsibility, could politicians actually win public support by actually pushing more audits to get people who are known to be prone to noncompliance to pay more, to pay their fair share?
I think this is a critical question. The public vision of the IRS was so strange. In my interviews, the public vision of the IRS is very strange. Because on the one hand, people who had actually interacted with the IRS had views ranging from, I would say, annoyance to genuine surprise that they'd been really helpful. That was the range of views, right? But they were not particularly bold views. They were like, oh, yes, I did have to call and ask about X, Y, or Z thing this one time. But when people talked about the IRS in principle, or writ large, let's say, several people referred to them as the men in black in my interview. I mean, there's a vision of what the IRS is symbolically. Several people would say, and I know I'm being extreme here. I know this isn't accurate, but when you ask me about the IRS, what I think of is the men in black. And so the IRS becomes a sort of symbol of a government that works on behalf of someone else and has unfair leverage over you, the little people, right? And I think that that's so terrible for how we run for fiscal policy, but more broadly for the country as a whole. I think absolutely, underfunding the IRS really undercuts people's capacity to have faith in this critical shared value, right? So when we make it seem more arbitrary than it is, and when we make it seem like these rules aren't being applied fairly, or that the rules themselves are unfair, I think it's really dangerous. And so one of the problems is that if you actually did things that were practically better, that you audited more in particular categories, or I think it would be very difficult to get that information through to the public because you're operating with this idea of what the agency is that's so... it's funny, people would admit that vision of the agency was probably quite unfair, and actually probably it was just mostly people working in their offices trying to do the right thing. But the vision of the agency is so negative. I think it would be really hard to get facts through that sort of symbolism.
Right? Okay, another question right behind Len.
Okay, maybe it's a two-part question. Most Americans, when they file a tax time, are getting money back from the IRS. They're not paying. So one is kind of, how do people's perceptions of what they pay depend on how much they pay at tax time or how much their actual tax payments are over the year? And the sort of related question is, when they get refunds, do they distinguish between refunds that come because withholding is coming back or refunds that come from something like the earned income tax credit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I found, to take your second part first, I found mixed results on that. People who got a lot back tended to know. In fact, they saw it as something like a savings account. Several surveys I've run have asked about people's perceptions of the earned income tax credit, whether they've ever received it. I have to use their demographics to assess whether it's likely that they did receive the EITC, right? But people I found were generally pretty accurate about that. It was typically low to moderate income people with children or adult children who remembered having received this credit. And a lot of them saw it as a moment when they could, you know, catch up on bills that had accrued over winter, especially if you live somewhere that's cold, so they had, like, utility bills, or they would sort of set that money aside for college savings or something like this. So that people, at the lower end, I thought that that was something that people really did recognize was a benefit. But I think if you're more near the edge where it's not a large benefit, I think it's probably less clear to you, right? And then one thing that I know that it's done, and I don't know how systematically it's done, but I know that it's done at least enough that it shows up in interviews, is people try and get as much withheld as possible so that check at the end of the year is as big as possible, right? So they really are using it as a method of savings, which might not be most maximally economically efficient, but also when you're taking into account for people who are living very near their full income, the idea of having to come up with $250 all of a sudden would be really painful. So they'd much rather just end up getting a very large check all at once and be absolutely totally confident that they have not, you know, they haven't even put on the form that they have children, you know, so that it's a really large check that they're getting at the end of the year. So I think that for people for whom the EITC is a important financial thing that gets them through the year, people tend to be aware that they're getting money back, and it's not just that the amount they paid in. It's more less clear at the margins. And then I found that it's not entirely obvious for people who aren't receiving EITC that it's refundable. That was not always clear. Some people knew that, but many people did not. You just thought you got your money back, right? Now, I knew I would forget the first part of the question. I knew it.
The amount they pay totally, the amount they get with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. I think there's let me give you an example of a particular person, which I think sort of captures something. This is a woman who was very good with her own budget, right? And it's very rare, I think, for people want to do math on the spot in conversation. Even I don't like doing that. But this was a woman who we were talking about various parts of the time. She was a low-income woman, received the EITC, knew she was getting EITC, and knew that next year she was going to buy a dryer. She was prepared for when she was getting that money back, right? Had two kids. And working several part-time jobs to make it all hold together. And so she was quite good at math, and so I had at one point actually asked her, you know, for instance, because she was working out percentages in her head, I was like, have you ever thought about how much you pay in grocery taxes? Because she lives in a state that had grocery taxes. And she worked out that math on top of her head, right? But so this was someone who's, by any standard, mathematically perfectly competent. When I asked her whether she thought tax rates should be progressive or like a flat tax, she said, oh, I think a flat tax would be fairer, but then what you get back should be based on your income. Now, that's a really, and I see the logic. I see it, you know, that you're like, okay, there'd be a flat amount of tax taken out from everyone, and then you would get your refund, in some sense, would be based on. So I think that there is some confusion around this issue, even among people with relatively genuinely quite high mathematical aptitudes. So yeah, I think that is a source of confusion for sure.
We got a gentleman in the red and then the woman in front. We'll get you next.
Thank you very much. Larry Checco. I wonder how much language has to play in all of this. For example, we see taxes as a burden. What if people started to see taxes as an investment in their country rather than as a burden? And it would be up to the government to figure out the ROI. Am I getting a good return on my investment? But I think on the issue of fairness, I think why people get really upset about the tax system is that you have a president, for example, take a little politics, who wants to pay as little tax as he can, and he's driving around in a big plane. Now, that's an extreme example, but my point is that why do I want to let people who don't want to pay their fair share in taxes drive on my roads, go to my public schools, play in my public parks, breathe my clean air, go on and on, drink my clean water. I'm paying my taxes for that. And I want to know, make sure that there's a, if not, go to the Cayman Islands and live. Thank you.
Or Mar-a-Lago.
Or Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, I think there's several important things I want to follow up with on that. One is, a survey question that I've asked a few times now is, what percentage of U.S. adults do you think are taxpayers? Now, Okay, there's some people, perhaps people like living within institutions, maybe really don't interact with the market economy, but like to an or, you know, more or less, almost everyone's a taxpayer in some sense of the term, right? Who's an adult, whoever buys anything, puts gas in their car, has a job, owns property, all of these things make you a taxpayer. So you find that there's a spike at 50% for Republicans, right? People see that statistic about 47% of Americans don't pay a federal income tax gets sort of remembered as half of Americans don't pay taxes. But even among Democrats, the average percentage of people they saw as taxpayers was somewhere between 60 and 70%. So that is a substantial sort of gap, right, between how people are at the end of the day paying some sort of taxes, and sort of the symbolic resonance of being a taxpayer and therefore, you know, sort of paying your federal income tax is the tax that really counts, makes you a taxpayer, right? And what's interesting is that even among just conservative Republicans, right, people who estimated the taxpaying population to be smaller were vastly more likely to, when I asked an open-ended question, what upsets you about government spending? When I asked you that open-ended question, they were vastly more likely to either say welfare or name a means-tested program, right? And the larger they thought the taxpaying population, the less likely they were to name a means-tested program as something they dislike. So I think people are operating with that sense that, you know, if I don't think you're chipping in, no, you don't deserve to benefit from the things that we're all supposed to be paying for together, right? Now, on the first point about Donald Trump, I actually think this is a really interesting political moment, because it's not that common for, although there's a fair amount of sort of anti-tax rhetoric in political talk in general, and the Republican Party certainly is at a very strong policy platform about lowering the income tax, disliking the income tax for a very long time, the idea that you personally, as a candidate, are going to say that you try and pay as little as possible and that it's smart not to pay, that's actually an unusual piece of rhetoric that's out of keeping with tradition in the Republican Party. So one question that traditionally speaking, when I showed you that chart of everyone being up near the top on civic duty, right, that's Republicans and Democrats. Actually, traditionally, Republicans are more likely to say that taxpaying is a moral responsibility than Democrats, more likely to say civic duty, right? So an interesting question for me is whether the data coming out in the next year or so will show that flipping. Now, I don't think it'll make a huge difference, because you're up near the top anyway, so the differences are small, right? You're talking about a couple percentage points here. But I think that traditionally speaking, Republicans are more likely to assert taxpaying is a civic responsibility than Democrats, and it's possible you'll see some shift there with the sort of prominence of the president's recent rhetoric on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's possible that with a national survey you might find that people who are more Republican think that poor people pay too little taxes, and people who are of more Vox type think that rich people don't pay enough taxes.
Right.
But my question is actually about undocumenteds, mm-hmm. who most of whom pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And often they're paying it with a false Social Security number. Mm-hmm. And what that really means is that they will never recover any part of that tax payment, that's cush to the government of whatever. And I wonder if there's a way to factor in to the discussion the fact that it's possible that undocumenteds are actually paying a disproportionately high unrefundable taxes.
So to talk a little bit about that, that's certainly the case. A lot of undocumented people are using false or someone else's Social Security number and contributing substantially, I mean billions of dollars to the Social Security reserves and other taxes. And of course, like everyone else, you pay sales tax because you are a resident, all these other taxes. And of course, to the extent that undocumented people tend to be lower income, which I think is probably likely to be true, they're going to be paying a higher percentage in sales tax than higher income people, same as any other person who's lower income pays a higher percentage of their income in sales tax than other taxes. So that's absolutely factually the case, and you are absolutely right to think that it is misunderstood by the public. People tend to think that, first of all, for many people, there's a sort of blurry line between undocumented immigrants, recent immigrants of an ethnicity about whom I'm uncomfortable. Like there's a blurry line there, and so when I was talking before about taxpaying as a way of contributing to your community, it's also a way of defining the limits of your community. and you know, you see this a little bit with foreign aid, right? Like we're raising tax money here, and it's going to those people over there who are not our community. That's not where tax money should go. It's certainly not where tax money should be prioritized. A very common way of thinking, right? So I think sort of implicit in your question is whether giving people better information about the taxpaying reality of immigrants in general, who of course pay taxes like everyone else, but undocumented immigrants in particular who are contributing to Social Security, will change.
And they're paying withholding.
Right, yeah. Right.
So you're talking about withholding. So my question was,
so yeah, and so I think that some people have tried to work out the numbers on this about what percentage of people are having their tax withheld versus you know, being paid. And then, of course, people also, you can file your income taxes even if you don't have withholding, and that some people do that too as part of... there are certainly immigrant groups who have worked to encourage people to do that so as to demonstrate how long they've been in the country and that they have been contributing their taxes during this time. So this is definitely a very active issue. My question is whether sharing those facts with people who have negative views of immigrants and undocumented immigrants in particular would change minds. And I, while I would like to believe that that is true, I am somewhat skeptical. Because I think, you know, as we were talking before about the IRS, I think that when you have a strong symbolism or emotional reaction to something, when someone comes at you with some facts about it, it's rare that those change your views. It's not impossible, but it's a real challenge. And I think, and I don't, and I should say that it's a challenge for all of us, right? That this is, whenever we're outside of our comfort zone on an issue that is not our expertise, and we have a strong emotional feeling about what's true, someone coming at you with some facts they bounce off us a little bit as human beings, right? So I think it's a real challenge that while that's factually true, I wish I had more confidence that it would make a difference to public attitudes, that the difference that you would like it to see, right?
A question in the middle of the room here.
Hi, Donald Myers. I have a question about tax reform. Over the years, there's been lots of proposals from one on a continuum. The most extreme case would be eliminate all deductions, have people fill out a postcard with their income and send it into the IRS. Sounds very simple. Any research done about what their perception of that would be? Would that be a good thing? Would people be concerned and worried that various tax benefits they view as benefits, like the mortgage deduction, would be taken away, even though it's questionable value to the public as well as individual taxpayers?
Right. So I think I should start by saying that people, I said at the beginning that people don't have a good sense of how taxes affect people across the income distribution. Tax expenditures and, you know, what would be casually called loopholes are even worse understood. So things like the home mortgage deduction, the regressivity of that benefit is absolutely beyond the scope of what most people understand about the impact of that policy. Not to say that no one understands it, there are very educated people who do, but that's not well understood. So this is a good example of when you do social policy through the tax code, it makes it very hard for people to judge that. In fact, they've done surveys where if you tell people the overall impact of the home mortgage interest deduction, they become much less fond of it, right? As a policy, because they don't like that overall impact, even if they like it personally. But the challenge, I think, with tax reform in general is that the details of policies are hard for people to understand. There is a strong incentive for political actors to mislead people. People do not have a good ballast, is how I think of it, like on a boat, to keep them steady, right? So the less information they have, the easier it is to be swayed by the political winds. And one thing people dislike very much on the subject of taxation is uncertainty. So major tax changes are immediately suspect, and very reasonable at the end of the day, right? If you don't feel confident that you understand tax policy as it stands now, I think it is quite reasonable to think that major tax reform is something that makes you quite uncomfortable, right? So I think that one of the things that matters a lot for tax reform is the political moment, right, and the capacity to get sort of a unified consensus among elite figures that this, you know, they're going to be winners and losers, but this is in general good for us, right? It also helps to have a budget surplus, I think, probably, to be working with to make that comfortable for folks. But the political moment matters a great deal, and we do not exist in a political moment right now where, first of all, elite consensus across parties is likely, and secondly, where there's a high level of trust either in government as a whole or in the other party's intentions. And all of those things, because people don't have a lot of facts to be working with on things like tax reform, all of those things really undermine confidence.
So it makes it very, very challenging. Now, I think that on the specific question of having, there has been work done looking at would people like it to get their income tax forms filled out. I think that does tend to appeal to people, right? Some percentage of people would want to, you know, as long as there were the option of being able to do your own taxes also, right? Then I think if you had no say and couldn't revise the government's estimates, obviously I think that would be very upsetting for people. But, you know, if you're given the option of filling out your taxes, but also you could just get the form filled out for you, here it is, I think that has polled very well with people. I think they talked about it in California for a while and it was quite a positive idea. But this is the big challenge of trying to conduct any major tax change in a time when trust in government is low and trust between parties is very low. And that it makes all of these things very challenging.
Okay. Well, Vanessa, thank you very much for a good conversation.
It's been great.
I think it's been very valuable for the audience here and the audience watching via webcast. So join me, everybody, in thanking Vanessa for...
Ignorance is bliss.
Okay, I'm ready to resume with the second part of today's event. We're very fortunate to have a very good group here to discuss tax perceptions. We'll have this session moderated by Howard Gleckman. Howard's a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center. He is editor of TaxVox and largely responsible for a big chunk of the high-quality content that is available on the Tax Policy Center website. So let me turn it over to Howard for the panel discussion.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. We're going to follow up a little bit on what Vanessa talked about this morning. From the perspective, actually, of some public opinion researchers and others who have a little bit of a different perspective, let me first introduce our panelists. To my far right is Bob Tobias, who is distinguished practitioner in residence, Department of Public Administration and Policy at American University. Bob was also the president of the National Treasury Employees Union and is a member of the IRS Oversight Board. Carlin Bowman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she does survey research work. Chris Farrisee, who was supposed to join us from Syracuse, is stuck in Syracuse, where it is snowing in April. I'm not even going there. So fortunately, Len Berman has agreed to step in and provide us with a little bit of an economist's perspective on public opinion towards taxes. Len is an institute fellow at the Urban Institute and, of course, was a founder and a former director of Tax Policy Center. We'll leave plenty of time after we're talking for questions from you all. Let me start with Carlin, who actually has just published an interesting piece in the American Enterprise magazine looking back at public opinion in 1986 the last time we tried to do a big tax reform. And I thought maybe we could start, if Carlin could talk a little bit about what she found or what she saw looking back three decades ago, how the public felt about tax reform then, and maybe we talk a little bit about how they feel about it now.
Carlin? Howard, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here this morning. My work at AEI skates over a huge amount of public opinion data. I'm as likely to be looking at public attitudes toward the bombing of Syria or President Trump as I am to be looking at tax attitudes. So I consider myself a kind of dilettante of data as I look over a huge amount of survey data in many areas. And I became particularly interested a long time ago in thinking about tax attitudes. I mean, they're obviously very important for the reasons that Vanessa outlined, and decided to look back historically at public attitudes. We take no surveys at AEI. I just rely on data in the public domain, the Gallup polls, the Harris polls, all the rest, to try to make some sense of what people have been saying about tax data. And when we have a period of time where you have a significant reform, as we did in 1986, you really can look at attitudes in a particularly interesting way. And so what I thought I'd do is just say, as Howard has suggested, just a few words about the differences and similarities in the public mood. As Vanessa said, the political moment matters very much, and there's no question that that's true. In 1986, Ronald Reagan's approval rating until Iran-Contra in December was above 60% in every poll that year. Donald Trump's approval rating at this particular point is in the 38 to 44 percentage point range. That matters, I think, in trying to push a major policy forward. As Vanessa said, we're much more deeply polarized than we were in 1986, and I think that, too, will have an impact on the possibility of tax reform overall. There have only been three occasions since the 1960s where our attitudes about government turned up and became more positive. After 2000, and after the 2011 attacks, after 9/11, attitudes became more positive for a very short period of time. At the end of the Clinton presidency, 1999-2000, the economy was humming along. People were very, very positive about the way things were going in the United States. The third period was 1984 to 1987. I think you all remember it was morning in America. We felt positive about the country. We felt positive about the things that government could do. And I think that really matters a great deal in tax reform. It matters in so many other areas. And one of the things I've been fascinated in looking at in terms of public attitudes toward rising inequality, the public believes it's real, it's serious. And when you ask them in the abstract, of course people want the government to do something about rising inequality. But let's take another question just on this one specific example that perhaps puts this issue in a very different perspective. And this is a question that's been asked four times by Bloomberg and Stelzer and Company since 2013. In thinking about the gap between the rich and everyone else, do you think it would be better for the government to implement policies designed to shrink the gap, or do you think it would be better for the government to stand aside and let the market operate even if the gap gets wider? Four times the questions have been asked, virtually identical results on every question. The public is split down the middle. If we had higher confidence in government, would we have more confidence in government to address income inequality? I think it's possible. But certainly attitudes toward government matter in terms of the success of a major reform like taxes, like something on taxes. If you look at the survey data from 1985 and 1986, and I looked at some of the averages, people were much more satisfied with the way things were going in the country. Part of that was morning in America. But let me just give you the comparison to today. In most of the satisfaction questions, satisfaction with the way things are going in the country today, between 65 and 72% said they were satisfied in 1986. That's 29% right now. That's a huge difference in terms of thinking about government policy and moving ahead. But what was most interesting to me about the tax debate in 86 was how little engagement there was in terms of the public. A stunning question asked a week after the debate was over. We'd passed a major tax reform bill, parties working together, took a long period of time. Two-thirds of Americans told Money Magazine in a poll that they didn't know enough about it to have an opinion. They had been hearing so much about it for weeks. We're not deeply engaged on these issues overall. But that may give Trump perhaps some running room here. And let me explain what I mean. He has something going for him that's very important going forward in thinking about tax reform. When people are asked in poll after poll, as they have been since he became president, what's the most important thing that Trump could do for you, for the country going ahead? What's the most important thing? That question is asked in a lot of different ways. And the answer is almost consistently create more jobs. Correctly or incorrectly, in the handful of questions, and right now we only have about 10 questions on this since Trump's become president, people think that somehow reforming the tax code will do something to create more jobs. One final point about tax reform and tax changes versus something like health care. It was interesting to me in 86 that people wanted change rather than the status quo. If you look at the debate we've just had on health care, something that's so acutely sensitive for all of us, people fear change. That's not true of tax reform. They actually think positive things can come from tax reform. That plus the view of creating jobs may, in fact, the tax reform may be linked to creating more jobs in the country if we make our companies more competitive, may give Trump some running room on the issue overall. But I don't think people will be very engaged.
Carl, let me ask you about that. I saw these numbers from your paper, and I was absolutely struck as well that after all that debate, after all that time, I was writing for Business Week mm-hmm. at the time, I was writing an article a week, and at the end of it, two-thirds of people had no idea what tax reform was about. It made me feel really good. the other thing that some of us old enough to remember 86 remember is Wright Rosty. So Dan Rostenkowski, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, started what was probably one of the first social media campaigns of in history when he went on TV and said, support me, support the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, and send me a postcard that said, you support tax reform. And I don't know, I can't remember what it was, but tens of thousands of people wrote back and said they did. Today, we're in an entirely different world of social media. Do you think, Carlin, that it actually would be true that after 2 years of debate over tax reform in 2017, that two-thirds of people would still say, we don't know anything about it?
I think it's quite likely, actually. And this goes to some of the points in Vanessa's paper. And this insight is not mine, but it's one that's just had an enormous impact for me in thinking about public opinion generally. And this comes from Dan Yankelovich, one of the greatest sociologists, probably the greatest living sociologist. And Dan wrote a short essay a long time ago in which he said that people like us, people sitting in this room, we base our opinions on the accumulation of new factual information. And we're not going to pay attention to the details. I'm not going to go home tonight and read the Republicans' health care bill or something about climate change. It's just not on my radar screen this evening. But he said that publics don't form opinions based on the accumulation of factual information. And I really want to talk to Vanessa about that. He argues that people always start with their values. I'm consistent, and that's why the kinds of things that Vanessa is doing and her research about what those values are so very important. I'm always struck in polls when people are asked, well, where do you get your information about the new healthcare bill? It's rarely ever from solid sources of factual information, from my friends and neighbors, from my family. And those are always conversations that start with values. So any kind of major reform has to start with values, but we will always be factually challenged.
Look at how much confusion there is about ACA, and that's been in place for what, 6 years?
One of the issues that Vanessa talked about is complexity. And it's interesting that when President Trump talks about taxes, he doesn't often talk about it in the context of tax reform, but he talks about it in the context of tax cuts or in the context of simplicity, which is, I think, another way to talk about complexity. And Bob, I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, about from your time at NTU and also on the oversight board at IRS. How important is this public concern about the complexity of the tax code, and how does it affect kind of people's views, people's attitudes about taxes?
I think that, as has been suggested this morning, that the concept of tax reform is complex, and it comes down to values and trade-offs. And the more complex it is, means there's more of it that I don't really understand. And if I don't understand it, there's more cynicism that I'm paying more than I owe and that all you out there are paying less than you owe. I create the narrative because I don't know. So the IRS and all of us depend on voluntary compliance to administer the U.S. tax code. And the Government Accountability Office recently stated, quote, IRS's enforcement of the tax laws promotes voluntary compliance by giving all taxpayers a sense that others are paying their fair share, close quote. So the IRS plays a very large role in ensuring or providing assurance that everyone is paying what they owe. But the fact of the matter is that today the IRS can give less assurance than it has in the past. And the reason that's true, very statistically, is that the tax compliance gap continues to increase. And this past year's, it's at $548 billion. So at a time when it's $548 billion, the Internal Revenue Service audit and tax collection functions have declined over the past 5 years by about 17,000 people. And the amount of the IRS budget in tax-adjusted dollars, in inflation-adjusted dollars, is at 2,000 at the year 2000. So my sense is that with less compliance, the pretty much stable 83% compliance rate is going to decline because the IRS is giving less insurance. So how that translates is that now there are about 54% of all filers use paid preparers. If I use a paid preparer, I have no idea how it's calculated. I get the form, I sign it, I pay, or I get a refund. I have no idea whatsoever. And what's interesting is that you would expect that I said 54%, it's about half use paid preparers, but 54% of people who make $30,000 or less also use paid preparers, and they use it primarily because they have to file a tax return to get the earned income tax credit. So whether you're at the lower end or the higher end, you have no idea what leads to the result that of how much taxes you pay. So I may not only resent paying taxes, but I also resent paying a tax preparer to tell me what I owe. So I feel helpless because I put my fate in the hands of a paid preparer while fearing that others are going to be able to manipulate the system and pay less than they owe. So I, you know, like the president during the campaign, do not want to become a loser, right? I don't want to become a loser by paying more than I owe. So tax reform that increases rather than decreases complexity is not only going to increase skepticism that you're not paying what you owe, and I'm paying more than I owe. So the calculation is I might start cutting corners to ensure that we're all equal.
Well, thanks. I think it's an interesting issue. I play this parlor game, which loses me all sorts of friends, but it's instructive. Ask people at the next cocktail party you go to how much tax they paid last year. Maybe don't ask them in the next 2 weeks because maybe they'll actually know, but after that. And it's remarkable to me that no one knows. They may know how much of a refund they got, but they really have no idea how much income tax they paid, much less how much total tax they paid. And I wonder, Vanessa talked a little bit about it, Carlin sort of touched on it as well, but how does this lack of knowledge of how much you're actually paying affect your opinions about taxes?
I would even add something to that. How many people know what percentage tax that they pay,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So when someone sees in the newspaper that the marginal rate is 35, do they think they pay 35% in federal taxes? Do they think they pay 10%? Do they pay 20%? There's no basis for, I believe that most people have no clue about what percentage their tax rate is, and so they have no real way of comparing themselves to others. But that doesn't stop me from doing it. That's the point. That doesn't stop me from concluding what the facts are, because as we all know, if we don't know, we create a narrative to fill in the blanks.
So I'm going to play Chris for a minute. He sent me some of the work that he's done. And one of the questions that he was looking at is they asked people how much they thought different groups paid in all federal taxes versus for how much they thought they should pay. And the results are interesting on both sides of it. And the first half of the transaction is exactly what we're talking about. So they asked people about the top 1%. And they said that they thought that the top 1% paid about 28% in all federal taxes, but should pay about 38%. Well, that 28% for the top 1% is actually pretty close. That's not bad. But then watch what happens. That's about the middle class. People think that the middle class pay about 30% of their income in total taxes. What, twice mm-hmm. what they actually pay? And they think they should pay about 23%. So they even think they should be paying more than they're really paying. And then at the bottom 10%, they think they're paying 15%, which is like five times what they actually pay, and they think they ought to be paying 10%. So I think what Bob is saying is exactly right. The people have this gross misperception of what the distribution is of taxes, and it really kind of messes up their view about what people ought to be paying. I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about Chris's results, but let me turn to you and ask for an economist's view about people's perceptions about taxes.
Yeah, so I was thinking about this when I agreed to join this panel at 6:30 this morning, and I was also thinking nasty things about American Airlines, but I won't share those. The economists don't think very much about progressivity, or they haven't traditionally. It's something we punt on. We say fairness of the tax system is up to the public. And when we do model it, we say, well, there's this social welfare function that kind of reflects the aggregate views about what people should pay at different levels. And then we do a whole bunch of math and make a whole bunch of assumptions and get these implausible conclusions that vary depending on your political preferences. There have been some efforts in the past, actually some efforts now, to kind of justify looking at progressivity as basically people on the left in particular coming up with arguments for, well, maybe that's something the government ought to be paying attention to on rigorous economic grounds. Lester Thoreau had a paper 30 or 40 years ago where he talked about the income distribution as a public good, kind of like a park, and a better income distribution would make people happier and everybody could share with it, and worse income distribution would make them less happy. And therefore, it'd be worth doing things to make the income distribution better. And there's a new growing body of evidence on the relationship between economic inequality and growth. And kind of for a long time, conservatives talked about this, saying, well, very redistributive policies were a drag on economic growth. And now liberals are saying, no, if there's a lot of inequality, it creates problems like crime and, you know, poor education systems and things like that that actually create a drag on growth. But I don't find the evidence particularly persuasive. The one thing economists agree on is on this notion that we call showing that we really know how to communicate with people, horizontal equity. And the idea is that people in similar positions should pay the same amount in taxes. Rudy Penner probably one of TPC's first conferences 15 years ago, made the point that there's not a single politician who thinks horizontal equity is a valid policy goal. That politicians, their stock in trade is convincing everyone that they're special. I've got a tax break for you. I've got other things that will help you you specifically. And the growth of tax expenditures, I think, is evidence that politicians think this is a winning strategy. There are more than 200 tax expenditures that the Office of Management and Budget tallies up every year. And Chris's research shows that there's a lot of support, bipartisan support, for the biggest tax expenditures. And also a lot of misconceptions, Vanessa pointed this out too, about how they work. I think economists' blind spot about inequality, maybe up until 20 years ago, maybe it made sense. You know, we like markets. We all go to graduate school and we learn about how, under certain circumstances, unfettered markets can produce enormous wealth, and anything you do to get in the way of these idealized unfettered markets would be harmful. It would slow down the economy. And 20 years ago, it seemed like markets were producing an okay distribution. Most people were experiencing growth in their earnings and incomes and feeling like they could get ahead. I think this last election is an indication that a whole lot of people feel like they've been left behind. And there's a lot of data to suggest that for large swaths of working class, that their incomes are not growing at all or not growing very fast relative to the overall economy. And the problem is that the things that are driving down middle class incomes are structural. It's primarily automation more than foreign competition, even though that was the big issue in the election. And as computers and robots get better, wages and salaries for people who do things robots can do are going to go down. So figuring out a way to deal with distributional issues could be necessary to preserve our democracy. The alternative is you might get populist demagogues who propose policies that are inimical to growth, like trade wars and barring immigration and building walls. I suppose the last thing would be a Keynesian stimulus. And that don't actually help low-income people that they're purporting to assist. So we need to really think about this as a profession. And I think the research of political scientists says we need to think a lot about framing, too. This didn't come up, but I know in other analysis, you can't talk about redistribution. That sounds socialist. We can talk about things like supporting work and supporting children. Another thing that economists tend to poo-poo is this idea of earmarking, trying to tie taxes to the programs that they're nominally funding. And economists say, well, money's fungible. You know, you can say payroll taxes are paying for Social Security, but it doesn't really much matter because it's just that money could be used for other purposes otherwise. But the fact is, Social Security, which is probably one of the most regressive federal taxes, has widespread support, and it's because people support the program that it funds. When Republicans were talking about things they might do to salvage their health reform effort, one thing they talked about was getting rid of keeping the payroll tax, the high-income payroll tax that was dedicated to extending Medicare solvency. It was, and I think it was because they saw that people supported Medicare, and that even though it was something that a lot of Republicans probably didn't like personally, they thought politically it would be hard to cut that back. So maybe thinking about ways that you can tie policies that are dealing with legitimate concerns about how markets are working, earnings, income distribution, with tying specific taxes to the things that they're doing that people might support might be a way to build durable support for these things in the long run.
Thanks, Len. Let me actually follow up a little bit on what Len said, and I'm going to play Chris for a minute and talk about some of the other results that he would have presented had he been here, which I think is really interesting, and Len sort of touched on this. So one survey asked people about a series of specific tax breaks: healthcare, pensions, the mortgage interest deduction, the earned income credit, deductions for charitable contributions, college savings, student loans, and asked people by party what they thought of these various tax breaks. And the results are very interesting. So most people like all of them. The one exception was Republicans, only about 44% of Republicans didn't like the earned income credit, which is interesting because it was an idea that was first created by Milton Friedman, but that's another story. But there was an interesting hierarchy. So overall, the most popular tax breaks were for health care. The second most popular were for retirement savings, for pensions. And that didn't matter whether you were a Democrat or a Republican. Then after that, there was some difference. Republicans tended to like the mortgage deduction, the charitable deduction. Democrats were more likely to like their income credit. And actually, for them, the charitable deduction was the least popular tax break. And then the other interesting point about this was a quarter of respondents had no opinion at all on all of them and there was no difference between Democrats and Republicans. So again, this question of are people aware of tax breaks and even those tax breaks that could benefit them? No. The other thing he found, which was very interesting, is the importance of self-interest. This isn't going to be a surprise to this audience, but probably worth noting that homeowners like the mortgage deduction. workers that received employee benefits like the exclusion for employee benefits. And students and adults with student loans like tax breaks for student loans. Then people were also asked questions about who they thought would make the tax code fairer. About a third thought that Democrats would make it fairer. About a quarter thought that Republicans would make it fairer. And almost 40% thought neither party would make it fairer. And then the same question about simplicity. 20% thought Democrats would make it simpler. 20% thought Republicans would make it simpler. And half thought neither party would make it simpler.
That's the right answer.
That's the right answer, yes. Exactly. And then finally, this is I always call this the Russell Long question. When asked what should be done to reduce the national debt, series of questions about spending, but then two questions about taxes. 60% thought you should increase taxes for people making over $250,000 a year, and 20% thought they should raise taxes on everyone. Of course, you all remember Russell Long, who said, don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax the fellow behind the tree. And that's certainly the result. The other thing that Chris did, a separate paper that's, I guess, not yet published, but we can talk about it a little bit. It's a fascinating piece that looks at direct spending for social safety net programs versus the earned income tax credit. And this goes to this interesting question of framing. People are much more likely to support the earned income credit than they are direct spending for welfare program, for example. They are more likely to think that the earned income credit is less beneficial to minorities than the welfare programs are. And then when Chris asked them about whether they thought these programs should be increased or decreased, so first he asked them about welfare, and about 37% of people thought the program should be decreased, and 26% thought it should be increased. When it came to the earned income credit, 24% thought it should be decreased, and almost half, 47%, thought it should be increased. So it's actually remarkable when you frame essentially identical programs as a tax expenditure, as a tax preference, people like it far more than what's a direct spending program, and they're least likely to racialize it, as Chris puts it in his research. So this question of framing, I think, is an interesting one. And Carl, let me ask you, as a survey researcher and as somebody who looks at survey research, how important is this framing, and particularly how important is it in the context of taxes?
It is enormously important. You cited Chris's work, and when people were asked who's more likely to make taxes fair, but if you look at a very large number of survey questions over time, there are just all sorts of interesting, subtle things that tell you something about how questions have been framed. For example, if for a long time Republicans had an advantage on cutting taxes, that's completely gone, Steve Moore notwithstanding, but it's gone. And I think because politicians' promises on taxes may be less credible than they were in the early 1980s. But if you ask which party is more likely to hold taxes down, Republicans still have a pretty interesting advantage on that, but certainly not on cutting them because politicians' promises aren't credible. And certainly Democrats always have the advantage on fairness. And so how you set these questions up, I think, really does affect the responses. And some of this goes to the traditional views of the Republican and the Democratic Party, but the fact that tax promises are so much less credible than perhaps they once were, I think is pretty significant too.
I would add that if I already don't trust you, which is what Chris's data shows, I don't trust you, then the only way you're going to break through to me is by framing something that touches on my values or my interests. So that's why I think framing is so important to cut through to get attention that is so dismissive at this point in time.
Let me ask each of you, I want to go back again to Carlin's, the results that Carlin was talking about from 86. So two-thirds of people were basically disconnected from the debate. We're about to have this debate again. How important is it? Does it matter if the public is engaged in this? Or will, in fact, their disengagement, as Bob suggests, make them more cynical about the result?
Well, it seems to me that in 1986, the sort of not too far interpretation is, in 1986, I would live in an environment where my kids would be better off than me. Today, I live in an environment where my kids, my expectation is that maybe my kids are going to be less well off than me. So I think I live in a much more pinched world. I don't see broadly. And so I'm really worried now. I'm anxious about uncertainty. I'm worried about what's going to happen to me. And I don't trust anybody. So it seems to me that breaking through all of that to have a meaningful conversation on the facts based on my perceptions and fears enhances tax reform in today's environment, enhances the difficulty of tax reform in today's environment.
Len, do policymakers have to engage the public in this debate, or should this just be an inside game?
That's a really good question. It should be nice if the public felt like they could participate. And I think one reason why tax system has been such a mess is that policymakers could hide behind the complexity, and particularly in the business tax area. I don't think anybody really understands how business taxation works. One of Vanessa's results, I think something Carlin found, was that people widely support the corporate income tax, and economists talk about how, well, it's a double tax, and you know, you probably ought to try to fix the corporate income tax so that it doesn't matter whether you're incorporated or unincorporated in terms of how much you pay in taxation. The debate about location of multinational corporations and border adjustable taxes, we're all consumed with this inside Washington. I think for most people outside this room, it's just background noise. So the interesting thing in 86 was that, you know, at key points, Ronald Reagan could give a speech and get people engaged. Dan Rostenkowski went on TV and said, "Right, Rosty, you don't see any politicians really trying to do that." The health debate, President Trump never even tried to make the case for it to the public. He was just talking to the legislators. It'll be interesting to see whether they take a different tack this time around. That's a long way of saying one is it is important to engage with the public, and I'm not that optimistic they're going to do it.
Bob, I wanted to ask you about another issue. About, we're talking a lot about people's cynicism and skepticism of taxes. And an issue that's come up just in the last couple of years that I worry about a lot, but I want to get your perspective on. Actually, I want to get everybody's perspective on it. And that's the effect of ID theft and this sort of ongoing issue. We just had an example the other day, happened again, ID, 100,000 were stolen. How does this affect people's attitudes about taxes, and are we doing enough about it?
Well, I mean, if people are surveyed about the Internal Revenue Service, they're most happy when they have no personal contact with the IRS. If my tax ID is stolen, man, I got a lot of contact with the IRS to clean that up, to get a new ID, and my fear about it being stolen in the future, my fear about how the information is going to be used ramps up. And if I'm afraid, how many people am I telling about my problem? So I think ID theft is a huge problem. And it's a huge problem as we see it today. And, you know, the story in today's Post was about helping people populate their form to get student loans. So the IRS was trying to provide a service, and that information was stolen. But in the future, if indeed the IRS is going to provide more online services, more contact through email, which is what taxpayers want, then being able to have secure a secure website is going to be important to whether or not that is used. So in terms of tax administration generally, in terms of how the IRS is viewed specifically, and how tax administration is conducted in the future is going to be determined by how secure those the IRS website is.
Does this, am I overstating it to say that this could put voluntary compliance at some risk?
It could, but so far what it's the ancillary service as opposed to people filing their returns that have been the big problems. So far it hasn't gotten to a critical mass, but if it came to a critical mass, I think it would.
Ron, have you got any sense of how this whole question of internet security affects people's attitudes towards government, at least in general, if not specifically towards the IRS?
I really don't. I haven't seen a lot of data on that. We certainly look at different age groups and how concerned they are about their own privacy, and millennials really are very different in terms of sharing information and being willing to do that. That's about as far as I can go, and that's really not on point.
Lena, let me ask you about another issue that Vanessa talks about a lot, which is, and Bob alluded to it as well. This is this question about, even though people don't understand how much they're paying, they don't really understand a lot about the tax code, they have this nagging sense that they're paying more than their fair share, and the other guy is paying less, is cutting some corners. As an economist, how does that attitude, even if it's not really grounded in reality, affect the way you think about how a tax code ought to be designed?
That's a really interesting question. I think actually one interesting thing in Chris's research is that over time there was actually a trend of more people thinking that they were paying their fair share. I think, as Vanessa said, it's maybe more of a concern for compliance than it is for design issues. Potentially, one possibility is it, to the extent people think that others are getting these huge tax breaks and they're not, then obviously it puts pressure on policymakers to produce more tax breaks for you because, you know, you make you feel special too. But the other thing is that to the extent that the tax system is based on voluntary compliance and you have its, like you said, $550 billion tax gap at this point, that if there were a growing perception that other people weren't paying their fair share, it would be more likely that people would tend to cut corners themselves. Although, as Vanessa points out, for wage and salary earners, there's really not much opportunity to do that.
But you don't. You said before that you think actually that this would have little effect on the idea of a broaden the base tax reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually could go the opposite direction.
The opposite direction.
I mean, the thing people don't understand, or my guess is they don't understand, maybe I'll ask the fellow panelists to comment on this, is that that people have to pay for the tax breaks. So because there's a mortgage interest deduction, there's $300 billion lost to the exclusion for employer-sponsored health insurance and these other tax breaks, people have to pay higher taxes, and tax rates have to be higher just to make the numbers numbers balance. So the question is, could you explain to people that their taxes could be simpler and fairer if they got rid of some of their favorite tax breaks or scaled them back? It would be a hard sell, though, because people think these very regressive taxes are benefiting. Some of Chris's survey research showed that working class people thought that they benefited a lot from the mortgage interest deduction, the tax exclusion, and they don't. For the mortgage interest deduction, they might be worse off on balance. Most of them don't itemize deduction, so they don't get any benefit from, they wouldn't get any benefit from a mortgage interest even if they had it. And even for those who take it, they only, it doesn't lower their taxes by very much. But my guess is people, obviously people don't understand that.
Carl, do you have any sense of whether the public would be willing to support a tax reform that eliminated these preferences, lowered the rates? Would they feel that it was a better deal, or do you agree with Len?
I do agree with Len. I think it's very hard to read the survey questions. I mean, they're such a blunt and such a crude instrument. I think sometimes that they can mislead you by looking for that kind of detail. But I think people would like a simpler and fairer tax code. There's no question about that. But whether they think they're going to get one is a very different question.
But isn't that the allure of the flat tax? I mean, the allure of the flat tax is everybody's going to pay what they owe, and it's going to be simple for me, and it's going to be simple for you, and we can do it on a postcard. So, but of course, then when reality sets in as to how much has to be paid, then people aren't so enamored with the flat tax. But it seems to me that idea, that issue, stays around and hangs around as an alternative to the complexity issue that we're discussing.
So it's one of the best political science papers, certainly one of the best cover, was this one called Homer Gets a Tax Cut by Larry Bartels, who was at Princeton at the time. And I think that one was looking at the flat tax, and basically it was based on an election survey, and it said most people thought that the rich weren't paying their fair share, and most of them thought that a flat tax would be better. And the flat tax proposals that were in place would have made the tax system much more regressive. I mean, basically, one thing people don't understand very well is that taxes as a share of income rise pretty steadily with incomes, notwithstanding the high-income people's ability to take advantage of tax breaks. So there are two issues. One is that a flat tax rates would not be more progressive than progressive tax rates. The other thing is that a real-world flat tax would have tax breaks in it, just like our current tax system does. And the problem is that those are enormously popular, and for politicians, the politicians are really drawn to giving people special breaks, and they would be if we had something called a flat tax, just like they are under the current tax system.
So Vanessa, I think in the discussion with Mark, raised an interesting question, which was she very strongly felt that it was a good idea that we go through this annual ritual of preparing our taxes, because it kind of reinforces the sense of social solidarity such as it is in the United States. I want to ask each of you if you agree with that. Do you think it's a good idea? We could, in theory, go to a pure consumption tax. We wouldn't have to do that. What do you think? I mean, is it a good idea to go through this ritual? Having been up to 11 o'clock last night, I'm not so sure, but what do you think?
Well, it is an opportunity for people to think about how the tax system affects them. The question is whether they actually draw any of the right lessons from figuring out their own taxes. There are conservatives who've argued that we should get rid of withholding, and we should make people, basically, we should make taxes as salient and as complex as possible, and it probably make it as burdensome as possible to the individual in terms of having to write a check periodically, because it would reduce support for the tax system. If you look at support for the income tax, which you have to file every April 15th or so, versus payroll tax. The income tax is much more progressive, and it's and support for it is much lower than for the payroll tax. And the payroll tax, it's part because payroll tax supports the program people support, but also it's not. There's no burden really in filing it. It basically just comes out of people's paychecks if they're employed. Whether it produce a better tax system is an open question, but it definitely making people go through the ritual makes them think about it.
Bob, what do you think?
I gave up filing my own taxes about 10 years ago, and I consider it a loss. I really do consider it a loss. I was very proud of the fact that I could manage doing the returns. I was proud of calculating my actual percentage tax rate, which I still do after someone else performs. But I was proud of that. And, you know, I identified with what you said. You know, I pay my taxes. And I felt good about that. And, you know, I thought about the highways and the roads and the, you know, all the things that that money went for. And now, you know, I get a email from my accountant who says, sign this, and I'll e-file your returns. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks later, you know, and write a check. And then 2 weeks later, I get the form and I look through it. But it's not the same because I haven't put myself into the effort. So I think something is lost when I can't connect with results of that, of filling out that form.
Okay, Bob, I don't want to put you on the spot. But so why did you stop preparing the return yourself?
Mm-hmm. Very simply, my mom died. I inherited a rental property. And I thought, oh, man, no, I can't do this. That was sort of the tipping point for me. I just can't do that.
You know, Jane Gravel has a good answer to that question. She says, well, I know how to change my oil, too, but I pay somebody to do it.
Changing oil takes much less time. Carlin, do we know anything about whether or not this sense of social solidarity is enhanced or breaks down because of this annual ritual?
Not anything that I've seen. I confess I've always wanted to meet the 10 to 12% of Americans who say in polls that they love paying their taxes. They love filing their taxes. And there are actually some people who, in one poll, I think it was a poll that Kellyanne Conway did many, many years ago, and you asked about whether you'd rather have a root canal or file your taxes. And you know, there are some people who said that they would rather have a root canal. Well, most people would rather have a root canal than file their taxes. But to me, it seems like it's important. When you ask people about patriotism, I'm pretty sure in some of the batteries, flying the flag, serving in the military, paying your taxes comes up as something people volunteer when they think what it means to be a good citizen or a patriot. So there's some connection there. Yeah.
Yet, not to be partisan about it, but the president bragged about the fact during the campaign that he didn't pay taxes, and it didn't seem to have any, didn't seem to hurt him at all. So what's that about?
So hard to think about anything involved with Mr. Trump, but they seem to like politicians who tell it like it is, at least who maybe speak for many people who are doing the same thing that he's doing, trying to find loopholes that are legal. If that's what he was doing,
He touched on that fear that someone else is not paying what they owe, and I'm paying more than I owe. So I like somebody who's taking care of themselves and is only paying what they owe. So I like that. I like that quality because I'm fearful I'm paying too much. So this guy got lawyers, he's got accountants, he's, you know, all of this stuff. And so I ignore the fact that he doesn't show me his returns to see how he does it. I ignore the fact that maybe for 20 years he paid zero taxes, but he's protecting himself. So that's what I think I identify with.
And I aspire to that, too.
I aspire to that, too.
Interesting.
Everybody needs a $1 billion loss to shelter their tax liability.
Let me give you all a chance to ask a few questions. Bill, how are you?
Thanks, Bill Gale. I wanted to talk about the simplification issue, which I think the discussion has been very misleading. It sort of suggests that simplification is a technical issue. We just need to turn the screws and get it right. And in fact, it's anything but that. If you think about not just the tax system, but the spending system, all right, then suddenly the tax system, the income tax, looks much less complicated than the alternative. That is, if you were to take all the social policies and deductions and the long list that Howard read, if you took them out of the tax code and stuck them in the spending code, people would really hate it, because then they'd have to file their income tax, then they'd have to go somewhere else and file for their charitable deduction, they'd have to go somewhere else and file for the EITC, go somewhere else and file for whatever other subsidy they get. So the fact that people have so much contact with the government through the income tax system means that it is a very good mechanism for running all these other subsidies through it. And so when we talk about simplification, we have to distinguish between whether we want to abolish dozens of social policies, which is a social policy issue, not just a simplification issue, or whether we're talking about simplifying literally the income tax, but complicating people's interactions with government by moving all those subsidies into the spending system. So I think simplification, everyone bows in favor of it, but I think the actual system could be much more complicated than it is, and there are actually enormous economies of simplification in running these subsidies through the tax code.
Well, you agree?
Well, I think it's important to point out there are good reasons to run some programs through the tax code. I'm not sure that politicians actually weigh the pros and cons of doing all of these things through the tax code the way Bill and I might like them to do. And the fact is that there are a lot of things where it's just there's really not a role for government, and it's not just it should be moved from the tax code to a welfare office, but the program just shouldn't be there at all. There are other things where a lot of things where the tax code is just needlessly complicated. The earned income tax credit, I think most people in this room will probably agree, is a good program. There are lots of reasons why it's a good idea to run it through the tax code. There's no welfare stigma associated with it. It's easier than going to a welfare office during working hours through the year. But politicians have made the program really, really complicated. Actually, figuring out eligibility in a lot of cases is really challenging, especially for low-income families that might live in three or four different places over the course of a year, and where their children might be with them for part of the year and not for the rest of the year. You could simplify it if you wanted to. We've got tax subsidies for education run through the tax, for higher education mostly run through the tax code. There's a question as to whether those should be there at all, or whether it wouldn't be better to just put more money into subsidized student loans and more Pell Grants. But even if you wanted to have all of these, even if you wanted to subsidize higher education through the code, you don't need to have seven different deductions and credits. Every single one of the credits has got a different phase-out range, and there are ways you could consolidate them together to make things simpler. It would be good if people actually understood how the tax system was affecting them, and the complexity gets in the way of that. So I don't disagree with your basic point. It's certainly right that when you're thinking about whether something should be done through the tax code or through a spending program, you should have a realistic view of both. And spending programs are not costless. They're not perfect. They're not administered perfectly. But there's still a lot more that could be done to make things simpler. And I wish it mattered more to politicians.
Bob, what do you think about that? I mean, from the administration of these programs perspective, Is it most efficient to run this through the IRS, or would it be better to run these through the agencies that do the direct spending?
Well, imagine yourself sitting on the telephone, getting a call from someone who's trying to sort out EITC. And the person on the other end of the line, who, as suggested, has moved four or five times, their kids are there sometimes and sometimes not, and you've already waited 45 minutes to get on the phone, and now you're really angry because you've waited 45 minutes, and I'm receiving this telephone call, and because you're angry, you're speaking fast, and so I'm asking you to slow down, and then of course that makes you more angry. And then shortly after that, you hang up, you file incorrectly, and then someone comes after you because you didn't file it correctly, because a lot of those returns get audited. Now, you know, as suggested, making that simple would save everyone. And there might be, you know, the trade-off is there might be a little bit more fraud.
You could actually cut down on fraud and make it simpler. It would just cost more money. It's a real trade-off. I mean, you could just say there's a wage subsidy. You get a subsidy on your first $10,000 of earnings. That would be really simple. And there's a child subsidy. You get child subsidy if you have kids. The wage subsidy could be tied directly to payroll tax withholding.
If you made it that simple, everybody would be happy.
Good. We should sign up for it.
Okay, we solved something here. Good. It's actually remarkable to me. Several of my colleagues at the Tax Policy Center participate in the VITA program and do voluntary tax preparation for low-income people. And these are people who are PhD tax economists or tax lawyers who are used to doing big corporate deals. And they come back after filling out the first couple of EITC forms, and they go, oh, my gosh. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. So I think that's right. It seems like there is a way to simplify. Bob, though, I want to kind of get back to Bill's question, though. Is it more efficient, though, in the end, to do this through the tax code rather than as direct spending, notwithstanding the problems that you addressed?
You know, I don't know enough to say that it would be less costly or not. But I think that the issue that is raised and often not really addressed is which would be better at inception. You know, is it better to run it through the IRS? And normally, these programs are attached to the IRS, or the rationale that's given is, well, the IRS is the only place around that could effectively administer this program, so we'll give it to the IRS to do. But that's not answering the question of what's more effective. Is it more effective to do it outside of the IRS or inside the IRS?
So I want to go back to Chris's research for a second. If he were here, I think he would say this. So I talked a little bit about this project he did looking at direct spending, safety net spending, and the EITC. Two things that he found, which are actually quite remarkable results. He looked at how people respond to direct cash payments. There are two things that they saw in direct cash payments that they didn't see in tax credits. The first one was that they didn't see that tax credits were direct spending, were government spending, when they saw that the direct spending program was government spending. And that's not surprising, I guess. But the other thing was, and I'll just read from his paper, it's important to note that many citizens fail to recognize or characterize tax expenditures as specific forms of government intervention in the economy. Mm-hmm. So not only do they not see it as spending, they don't even see it as government intervention in the economy. Somehow something else, even though it's a tax credit. So I think that answers the question about why politicians designed it this way. They're really off the hook. They're not only not spending more money, they somehow appear to not even be intervening in the economy.
I think that's going to be the real issue around infrastructure spending. Is it going to be financed with tax credits for precisely the reason you offer?
Carlin, again, the survey research question, what do you see in terms of people's attitudes about direct spending as opposed to tax cuts?
It's such a big universe. I don't know that I can talk about it in broad brush strokes. Again, they're suspicious of tax cuts at this point, and they're also suspicious of what government spending that just continues to grow and grow and grow in their minds, correctly or incorrectly. I don't have an answer because I think it's pretty complicated.
Other questions from the audience? Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi, I'm Rusty Guyman. Up until last year, I retired. I worked for Bob for about 10 years at the Oversight Board. I had a comment and a question. The comment was, Vanessa deserves a commendation for her work. As many of you know, the Oversight Board has done and has commissioned an annual survey of the public about attitudes towards the IRS and towards tax administration. And they actually, the public does not hold that harsh negative view that you often see portrayed. So I think that's a real service, and I hope that gets more publicity. The one of the questions I had is, and Bob and I have looked at this once earlier on, is that when we asked the question, recently the board survey asked whether you trust the IRS to fairly enforce the tax laws. And the majority, 60%+, basically agreed with that they would fairly enforce it. But there was a sharp difference in ages. The percentage in the younger group, 70%+, trusted the IRS, and then in the older age groups, maybe a little over 50%. And so I guess maybe to anyone up there, but maybe Carlin to you as well, do you notice the differences in the age groups, and do they stick or do they change over time?
Let me just say a few words about views of the IRS. I mean, I know those surveys. I think they're wonderful surveys. In the few questions in the public domain that we have about the IRS, a Pew trend, another Gallup trend, the IRS has now recovered from its problems of a few years ago. And it brought up one thing where I think I disagreed with Vanessa, and that is the notion that we should get people to sign up to register to vote when they're paying their taxes. One of the things I've noticed about government agencies that appear to be successful in the public mind is that their missions are very clearly and very narrowly defined. And once you get an agency that moves beyond its general mission, has myriad responsibilities of different kinds, those agency views and positive views of those agencies tend to come down very, very sharply over time. I mean, it's been interesting to me, the military, most highly respected institution in the country, all the scandals from Tailhook to Abu Ghraib just seem to wash over the military. Its mission is clearly defined. It protects and defends the country, and the military stays up in the stratosphere compared to most other agencies. But once you, NASA's view, views of NASA are extremely high. It does some very specific things. When an agency never wants to be in the news, as the IRS was a few years ago, but it's definitely recovered. Young people's attitudes on first of all, they're less confident in central institutions generally, whether it's government, marriage, big business, and perhaps those attitudes will change over time. They tend to be mercurial in some ways. I don't know the age data, though, in terms of views of the IRS.
Carlin puts her finger on an interesting issue. Yeah. The IRS is being asked to do more and more things, far beyond its you think of its basic mission as collecting money to pay for the rest of the government.
Well, and the scandal was actually because the IRS was asked to figure out whether these organizations were political or not, right. And that was really outside tax.
Exactly. So tax stick compliance. To its knitting.
Right. I wanted to just pick up.
Sure. Wait for the mic.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to just kind of follow up on a comment that Len made and relating to the assumptions in economic models about rational economic behavior. And I would say that Vanessa's work is very valuable and it also is kind of coincides with some of my experiences like Howard's about asking people, how much tax do you pay? You know, what's your effective tax rate, what's your average tax rate? Nobody knows. I don't know mine. and I think that the importance of the work is to try to integrate that work with what economists who are running models are assuming. And I think this came to mind because the Tax Policy Center published a short summary of a description of the models that they're using for dynamic scoring yesterday. I think it was an update. But I was reading it and thinking about rational taxpayer who was supposed to behave in a certain way. And there's seems to me, a very big disconnect between that theoretical rational taxpayer and the taxpayers that Vanessa has talked to and surveyed, and you know, one's personal experience. So it kind of means that when you're running these models using behavior predictions, that there's a disconnect, that you have to have a certain serious skepticism about what comes out. And I think that I would hope that the economists who are thinking about this would take that into account, and whether they are.
So I agree with you. I mean, rationality makes economic models a lot simpler because irrationality is kind of, there's an infinite amount of irrationality. But there's a discipline in economics, behavioral economics, that's actually trying to figure out how real people make decisions, talking to psychologists and others. And Bill Gale actually has done some work looking at some behavioral responses to retirement tax incentives, and it is helping to shape better public policy. It's the idea of signing people up automatically for a retirement account rather than expecting them to spend 5 minutes filling out a form that could save them thousands of dollars on their taxes over the rest of their life. It makes a big difference. The other thing is it's shaping the way we do empirical research. It's slow, but I think more and more people are looking for possibilities that people might not understand their economic incentives the way they actually affect them. And I think, you know, I was talking to Carlin before this conference, there are a lot of things in the tax code that are really confusing, and it's very likely that people respond to incentives that don't even exist. For example, there's this thing that tax wonks call P's, the phase-out of itemized deductions. And a lot of people think that it makes itemized deductions less valuable. Well, it doesn't for almost everybody. What it does do is it's a sneaky surtax. It adds 3 cents to every dollar of your income above a certain point. It doesn't reduce the incentive to give to charity. It doesn't affect how much you get from the mortgage interest deduction or anything else. But people don't understand that. And it's possible that people are reducing charitable contributions because they think this tax incentive, they're losing the tax incentive, and I think that's certainly a cost to complexity in the tax system.
Yes, sir.
Hi there. I wanted to ask a question that hasn't been addressed yet on either of the panels. I'm one of these weirdos who really does like doing my taxes at the end of the year. But you know, I'm a tax professional.
Wants to talk to you after the.
I'm a tax professional, and so I'm used to this stuff. And I get very excited actually when people say, "Oh, my taxes were really hard this year," because I want to know why. I want to, you know, so that maybe they rented depreciable property, or they had an AMT issue, a state refund, and they had to figure out how much was attributable to the state refund. Cool things. And about 80 to 85% of the time, I'm deeply disappointed with their answer because it begins with, "I moved states this year."
I'm what?
I moved states this year. And I'm wondering to what extent states are getting off the hook here a bit, especially on, with multiple residency issues. And to what extent are the feds actually sort of taking it on the chin a bit for the states in that regard? When people, looking at survey data, are they thinking about taxes, and are they distinguishing between federal taxes and state taxes? And do we have any sort of sense that people actually make that distinction at all?
Carlin, do we have any sense of that?
People tend to think of their taxes as a lump. There are some taxes that are considered much more burdensome than others, the local property tax. Certainly, in the few surveys that ask the question, people find that that's the most disliked tax. But I think they tend to think of their taxes in a lump sum.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. The IRS takes it on the neck for tax policy, right? The IRS doesn't create tax law. It attempts, struggles with, to admit it, to create, to implement what Congress creates. And so one thing that, in the interest of trying to point that out, if you'll notice, if you send a check to the IRS, you're supposed to send it to the United States Treasury. You used to send it to the IRS. Trust me, the IRS will cash it if you send it to the IRS. But it was an attempt to make a distinction between who creates the tax law and who administers the tax law, but I think it was totally useless. I think it had zero impact. But, you know, the IRS is held responsible for what Congress does.
Other questions? Eric.
Oh, Eric Toter. So I'll ask a question that you probably can't answer. The health care bill just failed, and I think one of the reasons was very low public support for it. And now they're moving on to tax reform, which everybody thinks is the wonderful thing they have to do. So I guess I wanted to ask the panel, what would a tax reform look like that would gain either public support or at least not big public opposition, public acquiescence?
So, Carlin, were there elements of the 86 Act that people like that? We know that most of them didn't even know it was in it, but of those people who did, were there any elements that you could identify that they liked?
Taking people in the lowest quintile, I guess, off the rolls. So of course, if you looked at the polls afterwards, most of those people didn't think they'd been taken off the rolls, so that was interesting in itself. But I don't know anything about what the provisions should be, but what I do know is it needs to be appear to be bipartisan. That's just incredibly important. I mean, to have a Rostenkowski and a Reagan working together, a Bradley and all the other people who were involved in that particular point was just, I think, very important to moving it over the finish line. I think so, because we're also more polarized than when we were before. So I think that would be very difficult. It has to have bipartisan support.
Glenn, what do you think?
I mean, I'm discouraged by the your polls that show that people are less interested than they were 40 years ago. And part of the issue is that maybe the tax code's not messed up enough that people feel like they understand that there's this real impetus for reform. You know, we in the Bipartisan Policy Center, we put together a plan which would have taken half of tax filers off the rolls, would have had their tax returns calculated automatically, and I like to think that that kind of thing might be really popular. And he said, well, simplicity would be helpful, but the thing you think back to is when the Tax Reform Act of 86, the first draft that was put out by Treasury was called Tax Reform for Fairness, Simplicity, and Economic Growth. The second version, which was the one that had political reality interjected, was called the President's Plan for Tax Reform for Growth, Fairness, and Simplicity. It basically moved to third billing. And by the time they were done, the only simplification was they raised the standard deduction, but there were a lot of new complexities.
Bob, any thoughts about that?
It seems to me that in a polarized world, bipartisanship is important, but having people participate in some way in this effort would be incredibly important, because that's the only way you're ever going to break through and reduce the cynicism and the skepticism if I have some skin in the game in some way that I'm participating in this effort. But that's so counter-cultural to Congress, whose attention span is limited, to say the least, right? So this would have to be a really concerted bipartisan effort over a period of time that sought to engage the country rather than being seen as a win if something passes.
It's interesting listening to Chairman Brady after having seen the experience of the health law, where he's now saying, well, maybe we'll hold some hearings, and maybe we'll have a markup, and maybe we'll do this more in the context of regular order. I think he's maybe a little nervous after having seen what happened to healthcare, so he may be taking your advice. Yes, sir, in the back.
Some countries are moving to a cashless system. Would I think Sweden is trying to do that, for one. Would that open the doors to a more fair or simpler system?
You know about that? I hadn't really thought about what the implications would be for tax policy.
They kind of money laundering.
Just like Vanessa had mentioned that employees whose wages are well documented have a very simple system in filling out their taxes, basically. Here, if one has no cash, all transactions are going to be tracked, basically, or have the ability to be tracked. Wouldn't that open the door to instituting a system that would be much easier, for one thing?
It's certainly true that when there is an independent source of information to verify tax liability, compliance is a lot higher. That's why wage withholding is like 99% compliance. But when Congress has tried to actually expand information reporting, particularly get information from financial institutions, there's always been a lot of pushback against that. And getting, probably in Sweden, it's a lot easier to get all of the financial records so that the government can monitor compliance. So you could imagine that, you know, potentially it could make compliance a lot higher, but the government would have to get a whole lot of information about what individuals were doing financially, and my guess is there would be a lot of resistance to that.
So the Nordic countries have tried another experiment, which is interesting in this context of cynicism about, you know, Len and I make the same amount of money, but he's getting away with murder and I'm not. Mm-hmm. So in a number of Nordic countries, tax payments are fully transparent. You go on the web and you can see how much your neighbor paid in taxes. They've struggled with this. I mean, there's been some interesting kind of back and forth there. But it's an interesting question. If we ever went to a system like that in the United States, where at least younger people are sharing everything anyway, what if we knew and we could actually see, how much horizontal equity there was? Would that reduce the amount of cynicism of Americans about the tax code? Well, what do you think?
Not if you just use the current tax system, because there are so, my situation, even though our gross income is the same, what taxes we pay can vary wildly based on the deductions, based on my depreciation of my rental house that you don't have.
You got that shelter, you know?
I got that shelter. I got that $2,000 shelter that I pay an accountant $2,000 to find for me. So, I don't think it would be informative. What would be informative if the tax code was simple, so we were really comparing apples to apples?
We're about out of time. I just want to take the prerogative to ask one last question of the panel before we go. Given everything we said, given everything we heard from Vanessa, everything that you all have said, what does this tell you about the prospects for tax reform in 2017?
I think we need to do a lot more public education to get real tax reform. I'm not really optimistic that we're going to get it this time around.
Carlin, what do you think?
I would agree with that. But I think Vanessa's work is just so important in thinking about how we might get the public more engaged. I think it's going to be extremely difficult, but I think it's worth a shot.
Bob, what do you think?
I agree with that. I think framing and recognizing that we're really talking about values when we're talking about taxes. When we're talking about reform, the reform is my mortgage deduction reformed, or is your oil drilling reformed? And so that's a reflection of values, but it's not spoken in terms of values. And people aren't challenged to identify their own values and how that impacts on the recommendations they make. So I'm agreeing that it's the framing, it's the discussion, it's the dialogue that's going to make a difference, as opposed to saying, well, you're going to pay $50 more, $50 less. That doesn't answer the question.
Okay, well, thank you all. Thanks to Carlin and Bob, and especially to Len, who jumped in at the last possible minute to fill in for Chris. So thank you all very much.